Folks, thanks for coming along tonight on a cold evening, and welcome to all our people on the Zoom call, some of whom are in Sydney, some, many of whom are not, for this discussion around the launch of The Boxing Butterfly, A Life of Conviction, Margaret Kinnean's biography introduced and edited by Andrew Urban. So we've got Andrew here, we've got Margaret here. They're both well known. I'll introduce them very briefly. Margaret Kinnean, SC, a barrister and author of The Boxing Butterfly. Andrew L. Urban, a journalist and an author. He's the editor of The Boxing Butterfly, and we've got copies of that for sale tonight. But he's also recently co-authored Zelensky, the Unlikely Ukrainian Hero. But tonight we're talking about the Sydney hero, not the Ukrainian hero. And we'll lead off with Andrew Urban talking to Margaret Kinnean.
Thank you.
Hello, Margaret.
Good evening, Andrew, and good evening. Thank you for paying us the honour of being here, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. Look, I thought it would be a good idea to start with a little context. Why am I here? I'm a journalist, and I've been for 25 years or so a film journalist and critic. So why am I here? How did I get to be here, standing next to Margaret? The story is simple. I always thought, as a journalist in the film industry, that the films can change your life. And then it happened to me. There was a documentary made in 2013 by Melbourne filmmaker Eve Ash about the police investigation into the disappearance of Bob Chappell in Hobart. And the investigation in the film was about the police investigation into his partner of 18 years, Sue Neill Fraser, who was charged and convicted of his murder. The case is a clear case of a miscarriage of justice, and it really hooked me. And from there on, I became not a film journalist, but a crusading justice journalist, if you like. I have since covered many other cases, unfortunately. Now, where this leads to is that I then, about 5 years later, published a book of my work called Murder by the Prosecution. And I dared to ask Margaret to write the foreword, and she very kindly agreed. And then a little later, I asked her to work with me on a book about her. So that's where we came together, and that's how we end up here talking about The Boxing Butterfly. So let me begin, if I may, by transgressing, transfer.
We won't have any of that, Andrew.
Maybe later.
You were forgiven.
Thank you. As you will find if you read the book, there are sections in it which deal not with Margaret's successes, but her low points. And one of them, curiously enough, was also a high point. And that was her now infamous and then applauded speech to Newcastle University law students in 2005, yes. The speech became infamous, and we'll talk about why. But what I'd like to ask you, Margaret, first is, you ended the speech with a wonderful admonishment to students: as lawyers, you have power, be good with it. Can you explain what you meant?
Yes, I was then a Crown prosecutor and had been for many years, and I remained a Crown prosecutor for 14 years after that. But I had seen that in particularly in the sexual assault sphere, there was a tendency, or by defence counsel, to engage in a war of attrition against the complainant or complainants, and to take every point, to take every appeal, to keep coming back, to stretch it all out, so that in the end someone got defeated. It was just too hard to keep coming back after appeals and separation of trials and so forth. And so I wasn't saying anything about the strength of the cases necessarily, but that they should be considering those people, the complainants in sexual assault, in a good way. And isn't it extraordinary? I find myself always on the wrong side of fashion, perhaps, in these areas, because when I first started out in prosecuting child sexual assault cases in the mid-80s, and that was about all I did, myself and a number of women and a couple of men, and we were regarded pretty much as the women's auxiliary to the department, to the Director of Public Prosecution's office. And people, other people, men probably, kept saying to us in the office, "You're still doing those kiddie sex cases?" And it was very pejoratively looked upon as something that wasn't quite crime. It wasn't bank robberies and murders. It was probably a bunch of lies thought up by women and children. And but it was a different style of offence in those days, because so much of it was in the family. That was the stuff that was coming out then in the family, and perhaps a bit in community groups, or even gradually in some church groups. But it was incest cases by and large, and that it was enormous. But it wasn't really believed, and magistrates would throw it out. In fact, the whole area wasn't believed much until I prosecuted the noted paedophile Dolly Dunn in the late 1990s. And I knew that it had to be proven to most of the community that there was such a thing as paedophilia. Because I knew, my parents, for example, just said, "Oh, well, no men are going to be interested in children. That's just impossible." And they just couldn't believe it. And they thought, I think my father thought my work was stupid too, you know, a lot of it. So I was appearing before a judge, it was Michael Finnane, and I said, you've got to sit, Your Honour, and there's plenty of press there, you have got to watch, he's videoed this stuff. You have got to watch it. No, I'm not watching it. You can describe it to me in words, can't you? And I said, I can't. You must have a look at some of this stuff so that you know. But what I really wanted was for the many members of the press to put it out there that this stuff does happen. Not only does it happen, but the little children are inured to it, which you could plainly see on some of these videos, how they were so used to it that to wave a $20 note in front of, and this is going back a long time, in front of their faces, they just themselves took down their pants and so forth. And so that was something that had to be communicated to the public, because they didn't understand it. But I was very unpopular for this area of prosecutions. And because it wasn't the fashion yet, and it had to be, taken up by others to become the fashion. And while it wasn't fashionable, I was criticised so much for any expression of even supporting the fortitude of a complainant without saying anything about the strength of the case or the merits of the case. When one compares not only what has recently been said by one of the celebrities in the press at the moment, but even going back to a particular royal commission, some of the blanket statements about how people and how many priests were guilty, forget fair trials, forget the presumption of innocence, or forget due process. Now I'm a defence counsel, and not so much. I expected, after so many years as a Crown prosecutor, that the New South Wales DPP might do itself a favour and sometimes brief me in trials. Well, my accountant's glad that they never did, but they never did. And so I'm now entirely a defence counsel, and now it's, oh, how terrible of me to represent these people, but it's a different, the, most people I represent now, the sexual assault area that's burgeoning is what you could call date rape. And so there's dozens, hundreds, it's half the cases in the district court at the moment, young men, young or even up to middle-aged men who have had a date with a young woman or gone out with her or ended up drunk with her, and then it's maybe days or years later that it's this complaint is raised. And only today, well, perhaps I shouldn't talk about today, but because it's not finished yet. But for example, if a man says in court, well, actually it wasn't a matter of consent because she was the initiator all the way through. Oh, so you're the victim then, are you? Oh, objection. Why is it now that the prosecuting authorities have to find a victim in any sexual situation? But that seems to be the way it's going now. And my whole career seems to have been the progression of sexual assault cases and how, but in the book brings this out a bit because, gosh, I was flogged for giving a lecture, a distinguished lecture, which included, because one of the only things that the students wanted to know about was why were all these cases limping on, all the SCAF gang rape cases. I never mentioned the name SCAF, let alone the real name of a man called MG. But his lawyers used the lecture to have me taken off a retrial because someone in the audience at the University of Newcastle might have some connection to some jury in the future, and the court constituted in a particular way was very happy to write what some may think is a very agenda-driven judgment, MG against R something in 2007, 2 years after the lecture, which took me off the case. And Charles Waterstreet was the counsel who took it, instructed by Chris Murphy, and he wrote me an email the other day, and he said, "Oh, congratulations on your book. MG and I still thank you for that lecture," because I was taken off and couldn't appear in the case, and another prosecutor was appointed. The complainant had no relationship with that person, didn't want to come back, and the case was lost. MG didn't get out of jail because he was in there for all the other rapes that he'd committed. So be good with it, you know, just be fair. And sometimes, and I know this now in my fourth year as a defence counsel, sometimes you've just got to plead these people guilty. And you can do a strong case for them on sentence, but some people really. So I've remained the same. I haven't really changed that much, but the cases that are now being prosecuted have changed enormously, and a Crown prosecutor has the duty to look to see whether there is really a case to go to a court. As I told the Royal Commissioner in the that Royal Commission, because I was taken before that Royal Commission after I'd done a commission of inquiry of my own concerning certain clerics in the Newcastle area. But the minute that was finished, I was to be torn to shreds, attempts were made to tear me to shreds, for having years before written an advice to the Director of Public Prosecutions in Queensland. It wasn't a case of me getting out of work or something that I might have had to do, and I just said there's no reasonable prospect of conviction in relation to some noted case in Queensland. And so I was dragged into that Royal Commission and treated as though I was a cover-upper of child sexual assault because of that advice. And as I had to apprise the commissioner and those assisting him, it's not a matter of whether the prosecutor believes the complainant. It's a matter of whether there's enough evidence to put before a court. And it was somewhat prescient if one considers what happened to poor Cardinal Pell.
Yeah, I mean, it's bizarre that that speech is now referred to by many lawyers as a significant and wonderful lecture, and yet it led to one of the worst lows in your career. But there was another one, wasn't there, that was even worse in some respects. I'm sure that you will all remember how the Independent Commission Against Corruption targeted Margaret. But the book goes into detail that you are probably not aware of, because very few people are, apart from a very small circle around Margaret. That was, in a way, an attack on her career and character without any ground at all. But it didn't seem like that. What was the first thing that you knew about it?
That was funny timing too, because it happened straight after I'd been to said Royal Commission. Because the worst thing that happened to me probably was that a rumour went around while I was doing the Commission of Inquiry in Newcastle that I may be appointed to the Supreme Court. And it was considered that the government was the right one for me, as it were. So there was a two-pronged attack, but I think the same people were behind it, pretty much, or the same two people. Anyway, I've told you about the first one, and as soon as I got out of that, my house and my son's house was raided without warrants by this band of unlawful members of the executive government, all they had to have done. I wasn't in this car accident. My son wasn't in it either, and there was absolutely no communication between me and the sober girl driving the car. But all ICAC had to do, a pretty easy investigation, was ask the police whether her blood was taken when she was taken to the hospital, because of course it was, and there's no alcohol in it, so it was all completely misconceived. But I think they knew that. I mean, that didn't matter, you see, because all you have to do is throw the mud, throw it up in the air, and you know that nothing will be resolved for years, and the target will be destroyed.
Now, why did they come to your house? What was the precept?
Well, they wanted phones, and they took some of the phones, but there's always more phone.
They believed what?
Because they were looking for some evidence that I had told the girl to fake chest pains after a car accident, but it wasn't a breath test thing, because it was such a bad car accident that she was taken straight away by the ambulance well before my son even got there. So, and by that time her blood was taken. But ICAC told the inspector, when it was later investigated by him of his own motion, a wonderful man now deceased, God rest his soul, Justice David Levine, and thank God for him, because he just knew that he smelled a rat. And he found out that they didn't really know what they were looking for. In fact, and I kind of knew that too, because at one stage, before they had crystallised their allegation, they asked me for my government e-tag. And I said, I haven't got a government e-tag. Oh, well, what about the e-tag that was on the car that was being driven by the son's girlfriend? And I said, well, she was travelling north over the Harbour Bridge, so I said, I can remember it so specifically. I said, you don't incur a toll going north. And it was an Englishman speaking to me, and he said, do you not? and I said, no. I said, gee, you blokes are amazing. So it took them ages to work out what the complaint was.
Our audience would really love to know what it was that triggered this hunt for you?
Oh, yeah.
What was the phone call?
Oh, yes. Well, so I think a few days later, because it was a car that my kids used but happened to be in my name. I knew the smash repairer because one of my sons works in that industry, and I had a beer with him down the pub. Some journalists in the Sydney Morning Herald think that I don't hang out with anyone other than lawyers. As a matter of fact, the opposite is true, pretty much. And anyone with any sense would do the same thing. But so I knew this fella from down there, and so he spoke, but he spoke to me on the tow truck driver's phone because the tow truck driver had taken my number. The tow truck driver was under investigation by the Australian something or other, whatever it is, Crime Commission, for some kind of drug dealing. And so they were listening to my phone, and the smash repairer asked me something about the young lady's chest because she'd recently had it operated on for the purposes of making it bigger. And it was about, it was conversation around that we were talking about fake chest, and what did she go to hospital for? Chest pains, and he was laughing, and so it came from that. But ICAC, of course, is notoriously lacking in levity or sense of humour, and didn't get it at all. In fact, when it went to the parliamentary committee, the only person few politicians who stood up for me was Reverend Fred Nile, and he said, look, I get it, I know Margaret, and that's how she speaks. And I understand her perfectly, and this is a joke. This is a joke, and what a wonderful and brave man he was, to do that for me.
So what does it tell you that the agency who's charged with rooting out corruption acts on a secret phone conversation that wasn't supposed to include you, about a joke with a tow truck operator, a smash repairer.
About a sober driver.
About a sober driver, and unleashes its entire aggressive force against you. What does it say about that sort of organisation? If I can avoid asking you that question, that's just a rhetorical question, but I would like to...
I might accidentally answer it.
I would like to say that, as a footnote to that story, you know that Margaret was not only cleared, but ICAC was thoroughly slapped around for the way they behaved. ICAC hasn't apologised. Has never apologised to anybody.
My husband, Greg, went before the parliamentary committee into ICAC and just asked for that, just said, because, in fact, had it not been my case, no one would have ever... Because mine was very simple. Anyone can understand that. But everyone else's ICAC case is very, very complicated, and it's almost impossible for even smart people who are interested to understand it all. But mine was so simple, and there, I know that Chris Merritt from The Australian has said to me many times since, I thought they must be doing it all okay until you... And anyone could see that. So Greg went along and asked for an apology, and then there was a big report. And no, we're not going to do that. So that was the current parliamentary committee. So I'm pretty annoyed but not surprised.
The corporate culture of arrogance. Now, this is a nice segue into the subject which is currently being debated hotly around the country, namely a federal ICAC. you gave some advice to then Attorney General Christian Porter about the subject a couple of years ago.
Mm. And what there's another terrible story, yeah, isn't it? Mm. Harking back to my first chapter of this talk. But yes, you can't have a body that chooses its own targets when it's full of public servants of the same mind, and it may not matter much. I bet it doesn't really happen now because there's a change of government, and anyone must be able to see the political assassination agenda of these bodies, but they can't be permitted to choose their own targets, just as a policeman doesn't choose his own target, just as a royal commission doesn't choose its own target. Someone else ought to say this should be investigated. And the second thing is, of course, what's happened to the presumption of innocence? What is the matter with these people that they are so into self-aggrandisement that they can't wait till the end of the judicial process before they take the credit for the investigation, as detectives have always done? They can wait. They don't want the public and the press is looking into their investigations while they're on foot. Nothing could be less likely to assist. So that's two things, two obvious things.
But there is one thing I'd like to draw you on before we finish, and that is the rationale that you put in an article that I requested you to write, which was why a federal ICAC is not likely to be particularly useful as opposed to ICACs in the lower governments.
Well, already there are about, I think, 11 bodies in the federal sphere that look to corruption in various areas for the police and other types of areas, the ombudsman and many, many. But the higher in government one goes, the more layers there are. It's almost and the less money, cash money and so forth that gets taken. There are just so many levels of decision making. And so I see that the New South Wales ICAC is back looking at local councils, where it belongs probably. Because maybe there's still something to see there, but not very rarely in the New South Wales or in state governments, but even much more rarely in federal governments. Then again, let's see what happens in the next few years.
Okay, thank you very much, Margaret.
So many thanks to Margaret Kinnean and Andrew Urban for a fine presentation so far. We're coming up to questions and discussion. I should remind you, we've got copies of Margaret's book, The Boxing Butterfly, A Life of Conviction, and we've got copies of that, and I'm sure, for sale, I'm sure Margaret and Andrew will be happy to sign it after. So if you both come up this side and that side, I'll take that microphone. Margaret, you come where you were.
Yes, thank you.
And I think if we just start off with a question to both of you, we'll start with Margaret. The meaning of the boxing butterfly.
I'm a boxer for sport, and the butterfly reference may have something that it was thought up by Andrew, who I've neglected to thank. Thank you, Andrew, for forcing me to write these things. But would you explain what the butterfly means? Because I forget.
Yes, well...
You just come this way, towards the microphone.
Yes, it seemed to me that as soon as we started work on this, and I was aware of the phrase that has been quoted by then-Commissioner of ICAC, Megan Latham, who advised lawyers that perhaps they should come and work at ICAC because it was like pulling wings off butterflies. And I thought the fact that Margaret was a boxer seemed appropriate, that considering how she battled against ICAC and won, the boxing butterfly was a good image.
Does she sting like a bee?
Yes.
Absolutely.
The double meaning.
So just before we go, there's a question here, just before we do, how did you put the book together? I mean, you're the editor, it's all your work of speeches and other speeches and opinions and whatever else. So how did you work together on it?
Well, the first thing that happened was that I took lawful custody of several boxes of transcripts and letters and papers and magazine articles and cards that Margaret had accumulated over the years. She never threw anything out. So I moved out of home and put the boxes there, and then came the task of going through it, you know, and selecting what we were going to use. There's so much material, so it was really a matter of discussing what we should include. And my aim was always to let her voice come through, because she had written a lot of articles for magazines and newspapers, as well as having had a lot of articles written about her. So those two formed kind of the bulk, except I asked Margaret if she would write kind of personal recollections of a number of milestone cases, not legalistic, but very personal. And I think they make some of the best reading in the book, very approachable. Some of them are quite funny. Some of them are funny in a black way. And so it became a process of gathering her words already written. And then we added, of course, we added, I didn't ask her to write the ICAC BART chapter. I wrote the introduction, and it came together as a chronicle. I called it a chronicle because it just chronicled her career.
The wonderful thing is, well, if I can take some credit for being so lazy and slow on it, because I thought that I might have a bit of time after I retired from being a Crown Prosecutor at the beginning of 2019, but then I got so many briefs in for the defence, which has been very rewarding indeed. But as a judge said to me the other day, isn't it amazing how terrible all the people that you prosecuted were, but what paragons of virtue everyone that you represent are. Although, as I've said, it's not just me who's changed, but I have been proud to represent people who've been rightly acquitted, quite a few of them since. And so the book has the benefit of a balance between prosecution cases and defence cases that it wouldn't have had I been on my game and doing everything as quickly as Andrew, I'm sure, originally hoped. So it's better for the 3 or 4 years that it's taken.
Definitely.
There's a question, Anne. There's a question here.
Thank you. Forgive me. Read your book, so I don't know if this is covered, it's slightly off what you've been talking about, but you are Margaret Kinnean. Has Margaret Kinnean got any thoughts on how large sections of the media could be got to understand and comply with sub judice?
Oh, it looks to be worse than ever now, unless certain action is taken. I don't really know, because unfortunately even large slabs of the legal profession seem to have the view that people in certain crimes, certain fashionable crimes, we can abandon the pretense at the burden of proof and call everyone victims from the start. And this is really happening, and prosecutors are doing it. So it can't be surprising that members of the media are doing it too, as though certain people or people accused of certain crimes don't even deserve a fair trial. I don't know how to fix the journalists, because I can't even fix the lawyers.
There's a question here.
This is a question to both of you. Andrew, you as a journalist and you as a lawyer. ICAC was renowned in New South Wales for leaking a lot of information, confidential information, to one particular investigative journalist who ran this material in the newspaper, the Sydney Morning Herald, with no action being taken against them. To what extent, A, Andrew, is this ethical and proper journalism? And B, to you, why wasn't action taken against them?
Well, I can answer that in one word. No, it isn't ethical. I think it's not ethical on the part of ICAC to do that. That's totally contrary to their charter, to the very notion of justice. But then don't forget, ICAC doesn't operate like a court. It's not like a criminal court. It doesn't have anything like the same kind of protections for its victims.
And it's always on a quest to increase its funding, so it wants to show the public what it's doing and who it's after, and it's better to do that before the case is finished, because they generally lose the cases. I mean, who can think of anyone else besides Mr. Obeid and Mr. McDonald who has actually gone the distance? And they would have been found out by some other body anyway, if they're guilty. But that they do leak, and it, not only do they leak, it was a bit of a two-way thing because, excuse me, sometimes that same newspaper could commence ICAC's interest in a particular investigation, could run a story, and then it would be taken up. That was in that particular regime covering two commissioners, which is now ended. So it was, but we know that there was a council assisting who used to brief the paper every day and promise them headlines the next day and line up the witnesses just for that. So it was all about public aggrandisement of what ICAC was doing, and that scalp seeking was a very, very unfortunate, because they probably missed any corruption that was happening if it was just Joe Blow from the Public Works Department, because that'd be on page 46 if in the paper at all.
But was it illegal, and were there any restrictions?
Oh, well, I did, that happened to me too, because when things were shut down, they still wanted to let stuff out. Like all my text messages to, and I think that's the reason I never got any briefs from the DPP. They even let out text messages that I'd written about my boss 9 years before, when he was, not doing very well in an appeal against a triple murderer that I'd successfully prosecuted, and it was obvious it was going to. It was a pretty short text message and pretty to the point and not very decent, and I better not repeat it. But he, of course, that was designed after ICAC was defeated to make sure my career was harmed, what was left of it. But there was the inspector said it was horrendous. The inspector, but if the inspector says stuff that says anything about ICAC, nothing ever happens. The parliamentary committee look at it, and then a few members on a particular party expurgate all the recommendations. This happened only recently, in this year, and the recommendations were cut down to nothing. So there's no stopping them.
You'll enjoy reading the inspector's report on ICAC, I'm sure.
I wasn't fully aware that your husband had sought an apology on your behalf.
And for him and my family.
And for everybody involved. But I'm also not aware as to what someone in your position, what rights do they have, when quite clearly the injustice that's been brought against you takes place. Did you ever consider, or do you have any capacity to bring any sort of court action against ICAC?
For a lawyer, I'm very anti-litigation. And after all, if I'm going to be involved in litigation, I might as well be one of the barristers at the bar table making a quid out of it. One of the problems with... I was very fortunate to be able to bring ICAC to a stop when I did, and the Court of Appeal went with me, and so did the High Court.
Can I just interrupt you there? What's really telling too is the Court of Appeal upheld Margaret's case. It was ICAC who insisted on being gluttons for punishment and went to the High Court, where they were beaten again.
Yes.
But they were so arrogant that they wouldn't give up.
Yes, it's often said, I had to go all the way to the High Court. Well, I did have to go, but ICAC was the ones who decided to take it there, and their behinds were tanned even worse by the High Court than this state court, where where they all know each other, had done. But after that, there was a wicked thing called the ICAC Validation Act. Retrospective legislation was passed, which pretty well stopped anyone doing what I'd done or seeking any relief, because it declared that all of ICAC's misfeasances were now legal. And that there was no faster bill passed through the Parliament than that overnight one night. And now I have so many politicians to whom I've spoken have said, oh, look, no one explained it to us. And come on. That was outrageous, but it's probably stopped any actions. Anyway, I don't want to keep living all of that stuff, and money can't, if you got any, wouldn't repay what happened to my family. Because remember, it wasn't just me. My eldest son Steve, and his girlfriend Sophia. It was against the three of us, and the High Court case is the three of us. So that's why I took the action. You know, if it had just been aimed at me, I would have just run the gauntlet and done my best, knowing that I was completely innocent. But I was always so incensed that because of me, these two they weren't public servants. They didn't know what ICAC was. They'd never heard of it. And in fact, most people hadn't before this. And they'd never heard of it, but they were raided and they were saying, are you the police? No, we didn't know what it was about. So they had their phones and everything. Now, I didn't know whether they'd been up to no good in any other direction. I'm not saying that I thought they would, but they, who knows what young people send strange photos or whatever they do, and every parent here knows about that. Why should they lose all their rights that every citizen has, every other citizen who's not a public servant or a politician, has a right to silence, has a right to have things taken with them only by warrant? So I moved quickly to say to protect them from this invasion that they was no part of ICAC's business.
An amendment to the Crimes Act changing the law of sexual consent in New South Wales recently commenced. Do you have any particular view on that change to the law?
I've deliberately not looked at it terribly closely because I'm still running cases on the old law, so I don't really want to get mixed up. but all it's going to mean is it's still going to be word against word. It's still going to be, well, I did ask. No, you didn't. It's just another layer of things that they'll... It doesn't really help. Maybe what they meant to do was to educate everyone with making sure that there was always consent. And perhaps that should have been tried in the first instance. This is just going to lengthen cases, and I guarantee you the vast bulk of the cases that I'm seeing in this area are men of absolutely unblemished character and with very, very good defence cases, dealing with young women who might have drunk too much or might have told a very different story to their girlfriends the next day, and then girlfriends will get on the bandwagon and say, that must be, I'll take you to the hospital, I'll take you to the police, and this train takes off, and parents have to mortgage their houses to get these boys represented. So we're seeing before the courts a genre of young man who never would have been before any court before in the history of mankind. It looks like a move to criminalise a greater range of people. And it's just going to be longer trials, more legal arguments. And so whereas it might now cost you $200,000 to get justice after a false complaint of sexual assault, it'll cost you $400,000 with the new laws.
Or your parents.
Yeah, your parents, yeah. And that doesn't all go to me. The solicitors take most of it. Yes, sir.
Okay. Margaret, you were part of the Folbing case. Were you?
A couple of years. No, I didn't prosecute it. Mark Tedeschi did.
Do you have any opinions on it? Because it's interesting that it constantly seems to be getting attention.
Yes.
Can you comment on why you think that?
I represented Mrs. Folbig's former husband in the inquiry conducted by Justice Reg Blanche about 2 or 3 years ago. And I got to cross-examine Mrs. Folbig, and she's never been cross-examined before, and I had her diaries. And the cross-examination was pretty probative of a number of things. So what we must bear in mind that even though I think two of her children had some arguable genetic predisposition to cot death, two didn't. These diaries were very, very damning. I was fairly proud of my cross-examination, and I was representing the undeniable victim, the man whose four children had been killed, suspicion attaching to him whatsoever, because he wasn't there on many of the times, on most of the times. One child was attacked twice, and didn't die the first time, but was blinded and became disabled. But then, not long after that, he died. So I do have a particular view about it, and science is not going to answer it. And some of the arrogance of the scientists that come forward and say, "Oh well," it's curious what's happened, because of course it went to the High Court in the first place, and Justice Blanche said, "Well, it's gone through every appeal thing, but after the cross examination of Mrs. Folbig, her guilt is even more. I'm more sure of her guilt than before." So that's what I think, and I think it's very, very cruel and very difficult for Mr. Folbig to have to go through all of this, and his family to go through all of this again.
Okay, Jonathan.
Does a professional lifetime prosecuting and defending sexual assault cases take a toll? And if so, what sort of toll has it taken?
While I was a parent of young children, I was always thinking that someone was going to get them. So I was very suspicious of people. But I don't know what I'd be like without that history of prosecuting and defending terrible crimes, not just sexual assault, but murders. I've always pretty much done cases of personal violence, sexual assault, murders, and serious assaults, because I was always briefed in those, because it was a caring thing, because I've always been accused of getting too close to the complainants or the bereaved relatives, and now that I'm thought to get too close to my own clients. It's interesting how very similar it is to be working with people that I think are that shouldn't be before the justice system. So it hasn't been much of a change, but it's good for you to give. I think it's been good for me to give, and maybe my sense of humour is very warped and very black, and maybe I drink too much beer to cope with it all. But I might have always drunk too much beer anyway.
I'm not going to say anything about that. But just if I can make one point on this. My very first interview with Margaret in her chambers, now as a defence barrister, I asked her what it was that connected the two worlds. And she said something to me just really made sense. As a prosecutor, she felt empathy towards the victims. As a defence barrister, she feels empathy towards the accused. So she's living on empathy. You know, that's her drug.
Yeah, I like people. I love people, but gee, there's quite a few people.
Most people
who hate me.
Question down there.
In light of the media, social media, and as you say, the extraordinary commentary we sometimes get from the legal profession representing people, after 800 years, will we end up with just judge alone trials?
Well, I hope not. I hope not. I'm a great believer in juries. I think they're very smart. And 12 jurors have got to be a lot smarter than one one judge. Of course. And they've got a much more life experience and much more wisdom. And they're very... and remember, our society is very diverse now. And it's actually very uplifting to see the diversity in juries. I've got a jury right at the moment. Very diverse racially and, of course, in every way. And that's great. It's the connection with the community. It's keeping the community, because remember, judges are subject to what would they call it? Professional development, in which they are told and of what we now all think in the community about particular crimes, in particular the sexual assault area. So. It's a brave judge to go against that tide, really. But the community will pull it back. The community has sons and brothers and fathers, and they know what goes on in life. And 12 jurors will always outsmart a single judge.
I've got to be very quick now. We don't use this question there. Yeah,
very
quick, yeah.
Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Ella. It's lovely to see you. Yes. Robin.
Yes, is this on? Can
yes.
You hear
me? Yes.
It's great. Sorry, to see you, Robin. Robin was a spectator in the case I was proudest of.
Been on for a year.
Good heavens.
Anyway, you were brilliant. Sadly, it went the other way eventually. Yeah. But
judges.
Never mind.
That was the case that was being stuffed up by the boss. Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, look, back to ICAC. Considering what you went through, considering that somebody in Victoria recently committed suicide as a result of their equivalent of ICAC, considering that Eddie O'Bean, etc., probably would have got found out anyway, and considering that most of the ICAC work seems to be politically in one direction, do we need ICAC?
Certainly not.
What would happen if we didn't have ICAC?
Well, the state would save an awful lot of money, and a really large number of very decent people that I know wouldn't have had their lives trashed. Really decent people: Murray Keir, Michael Gallagher, Sharif Ghazal, Steve Pearce. I could go on and on and on. I really could, and I've befriended all of these people, and we stand together against this
hideous
outfit. Not
to mention a couple of premiers.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Poor Gladys Berejiklian. It all had to be done so quickly. They couldn't wait for 2 weeks while she delivered us from the nonsense COVID business. But they took her glory away because it had to be done then. And now, where's the report?
Still no report.
8 months later, nothing. Why are we putting up with it?
We've got two last questions. There's one here and one there. Okay, go be quick.
Maybe cold comfort, but me and my friends thought the hit job that ICAC did on you, and that was obviously a setup after that car accident, small comfort. I agree with Chris Merritt. I have absolutely no faith in ICAC now, and that disgusting legislation, the validation bill, is an absolute shame on the Baird government.
It is.
And I wish you well in the future on that, and let's
Thank
hope
you,
we never see the likes of this infamy again.
Thank you very much, Leon.
Okay, there's a question, Jay.
Yeah. Other than my despair about the legal side, I'm not being any non-lawyer here, but what is, if you were in charge of a massive reform, or one that may start small but may impact for the community's benefit, what reform could you bring to the judicial system? And I know this is ridiculous, you know, 3 hours we've got in time.
I can think of a simple one, because I've been thinking about this with all the clients I've got. There's quite a few hung juries, and maybe the more diverse juries get, the more hung juries there'll be. That's very unfair on people who are tried, because then they have to find the same amount of money for a jury again. So, yes, they do. And similarly, if a court of appeal... criminal appeal gives people a retrial on the basis that a judge has got the directions wrong. They have to, through no fault of their own, they've got to come up with the money for another trial. So if people were given if there's a hung jury, maybe the DPP should have to cough up the money for the accused person so that they don't have to pay a pay for a trial that didn't finish. Or if the courts have to pay when the judge gets it wrong, perhaps these that they'll be more careful. Perhaps the DPP will not be putting put to trial cases that are so weak that the jury can't agree.
So in final comments, we start with Andrew. What are you up to next? And Margaret, what are you up to next? Are you writing books, giving speeches?
Yes. Well, we just spoke about Gladys Berejiklian, and that's my next book, which is basically ready to go, except I'm waiting for ICAC to issue its. She didn't participate, but she knows that it's there.
So we expect a late publication date. And correct. Margaret Canaan, what are you up to next?
I'm still enjoying. I'm booked out till middle of next year. I've got some good cases coming up, deserving cases, and I'll keep working hard for my client, which is a greater burden in many ways, but it's very simple when you're only working for one person.
So many thanks to Margaret Canaan and Andrew Urban for a lively presentation tonight. And as Andrew was mentioning, there are so many cases, real cases dealt with in this book, from the prosecution side, from the defence side, as along with speeches and other valuable insights. So it's a great compilation, and it's for sale tonight. And Anne will sell other books online when we put this up on our website. But for tonight, thanks to both of you, and well done.
Well done, Andrew.
Thank you. There we go. Thanks, folks.